nice introduction and the invitation to present this work here. So as you could conclude from the title, there are two aspects to it. So in the RG view, we will do functional randomization proofs and talk about asymptotic safety, and the aim of the talk is to compare predictions which we can do in the continuum to what people can actually measure and see on the lattice, and then see how the two results compare. So you can find them. So one part of the talk is already published. This is work with Martin Reuter. And then there's also some preliminary results which we obtained with a student of mine, Stefan Rechenberger. So the outline of the talk will be as follows. So first there will be a rather broad introduction to the topic. So we have to study two ingredients. The first is functional randomization proof and how this works. And the second one is rather a little bit more mathematical. It's about quantifying properties of fractals. So functions you can define on a fractal to classify the structures that are appearing there. In the second part of the talk, I want to apply these properties of fractals to the spacetimes that we get from the functional randomization group. So there will be a typical example showing the features that emerge here. We will compare these features to things that have been measured in Monte Carlo simulations, and then briefly an outlook on corrections to the predictions we find here. So since we talk about spacetimes and fractals, there is a starting point. What do we know? And when we do standard model physics, we know this works very well. And from the structural point of view, we are studying quantum field theories in four-dimensional Minkowski space. So we have a set of particles which forms the standard model. We can test the model in particle collisions and collider physics, and this works extremely well. So if we have quantum field theory, four dimensions, this describes the physics we observe in experiments extremely well. Then you can ask the following questions. Do we know that we really live in a four-dimensional space-time? So in principle, you could study deviations from the dimension of space-time away from four and say these deviations are small and say, okay, we are living on a space-time which actually misses some points. And then there have been people who studied these questions, and by studying loop corrections to scattering processes, you can obtain bounds on this number epsilon, which is up here. So if you do precision QED measurements, so this is the typical length scale where these measurements take place, then you get a bound that this number should be very close to 4, so up to 10 to the minus 8. If you study hydrogen atoms, spectra and hydrogen atoms, you even get a better bound, 10 to the minus 11. And you can also go up to cosmological scales and say also here the number is very well in agreement with 4. So that means that our space-time, there's on these ranges, is very well in agreement with four-dimensional flat space. However, since there is the quantum gravity seminar sitting around here, one can have a theoretical look on this question. And surprisingly, many quantum gravity approaches actually predict that at some energy scale, there will be a deviation from the four space-time dimensions we observe. So starting from the randomization group, there is an interpolation between four space-time dimensions at macroscopic scales. And then intrinsic to the constructions, there's a so-called UV fixed point. And here the theory becomes essentially two-dimensional. We will come to this point later on. So let's see what other approaches say about this topic. So there's the causal dynamical triangulations program. So here you put the gravitational action essentially on the lattice. You discretize it. And you evaluate the partition sums in a Monte Carlo simulation. And here the people also find that if you look at diffusion processes with long time scales, their effective space times essentially look four-dimensional, while on short time scales, it's effectively two-dimensional. And then we can continue the list. So in loop quantum gravity, you also have a similar dimensional reduction if you look at the area spectrum of or the area operator, which appears in loop quantum gravity. There are two regimes. So for large areas, it behaves like area square. And for small areas, which are comparable to the Planck length, it becomes this linear relation. Similar things happen in string theory. So if strings are above the Hagedorn temperature, you also observe an essentially two-dimensional theory. Well, there's Horava-Lifschitz, where you also have changes in the effective dimension at high energies. You can study the strong coupling limit of the Wieler-De-Witt equation, and they all boil down to the point that at high energies, there's something going on with the dimension of space-time. So since this talk will be about asymptotic safety and functional randomization group, let's see in more detail how these features arise in this particular proposal. So the general idea about this randomization group is summarized in this slide. So the idea is we start from a path integral from quantum gravity. And what we want to do is we want to solve this particle path integral, but not in one go. So we take the fluctuations that appear in the system, we organize them according to momentum, and then we integrate out shell after shell of these momentum fluctuations. So the idea is that we start at some classical action, which we want to quantize, and then we take steps in integrating out fluctuations. And once we have integrated out all fluctuations, we get our infrared physics, and there we obtain the standard effective action, which you know from quantum field theory. So this is the cartoon version. How can we do this in practice? So what we will do is we start from this classical action, and there will be coupling constants going in this action, like Newton's constant, cosmological constant, or other coupling constants, and we will promote them to depend on the energy scale K. And then in the second step, we want to have a machinery which describes us how these coupling constants change once we do an RG step in this picture. And this change is summarized in the beta functions of your theory. So this is the structure that we want to study. So now we need an equation which allows us to obtain these beta functions. So as you probably all know, perturbation theory will not work in the case of gravity. So gravity is perturbatively non-randomizable. So we need to find a way to compute these beta functions in some non-perturbative approximation. And the way to go was a proposal by Christoph Wetterich in the early 90s, is to do a functional randomization group equation. So structurally, this is depicted here. You have a left-hand side. So this tells you how your action functional changes in an RG step. And the right-hand side is a rather complicated operator trace. So here, in this case, you have the second variation of your action sitting in. And this RK is a regulator which suppresses fluctuation modes at low energies. So what this combination of regulators in here does is it makes this equation a formally exact equation, and it ensures that the contribution to the right-hand side is actually localized at the certain momentum scale k. So you see, by looking at the derivative of Rk, there's no contribution coming from high momentum modes, while this Rk down here ensures that there are no singularities at IR. So the right-hand side localizes at a certain interval, and then you can shift your scale k in order to integrate out quantum fluctuations with this equation. There are two important limits to this equation. So at one point, since it's a differential equation, we have to set initial conditions. So this defines our initial action at the UV. And then we can use this equation to evolve this initial condition down to k equals 0. And once we go down to k equals 0, we have essentially covered or included all quantum fluctuations in this gamma. And this gamma k becomes the standard effective action. So there's the cartoon version of what's going on with this RG scale k. So at high energies, we can use this gravitational version of this equation to zoom in and analyze the microstructure of space-time depicted here. And once we dial k to be close to 0, we hope to recover classical general relativity and here depicted gravity at large scales. Okay, this was all very formal. Now, can we do this in practice? What we cannot do is give exact solutions to this equation. So at some point, you have to go into an approximation. And the simplest approximation you might do is you approximate the gravitational action by the Einstein-Hilbert action. So in this case, you have here the Einstein-Hilbert form. You supplement it by a gauge fixing and ghost term. And what is now different is that you now have coupling constants sitting in here, which depend on the RG scale k. Then you can substitute this equation into the exact flow equation and compute the terms which are proportional to r and the volume of your spacetime. From this comparison, you can then read off the flow equation for g and lambda and obtain the beta functions in this approximation. So in order to analyze these functions, it's convenient to change from these dimension-full quantities to dimensionless ones. And then you can write down explicit equations which tell you how these dimensionless ones change with the energy scale k. So these equations are given here. And the only point that is noteworthy about these equations is the structure of this eta n here. So here you see that you have the Newton's constant appearing in the numerator and also in the denominator. So if you compare this expression to a typical one-loop computation, you see, or perturbative computation, you see that by doing this game of substituting this into the exact flow equation and computing the beta functions, you essentially obtained a non-perturbative result. So in a sense, you have summed up contributions from all kinds of loop contributions. So this is depicted here in the denominator. The second one is you have very explicit expressions for these beta functions. So you can solve the system, and you can study it either analytically or numerically. So it's all here. From the viewpoint of defining a fundamental theory, what is of interest is that you want to look for zeros of these beta functions, so-called fixed point, because these allow you to take a continuum limit or define a fundamental theory. So then you can look at this explicit expression up here and check, so what can we do to get these zeros? And the first thing is obviously you can set Newton's constant and the cosmological constant to 0. So you see then this expression vanishes identically, this also. So this is a fixed point. So this should be the fixed point that actually is the one featuring in perturbation theory. And it comes with the property that it is actually a saddle point in the G lambda plane. So if you start a G flow with non-trivial Newton's constant, then it will not arrive at this fixed point in the UV. So you cannot take this fixed point in order to define the fundamental theory of gravity. And this is essentially the result of Toft and Weltmann in the language of fixed points and the randomization group. However, it turns out that there is a second solution which defines a fixed point of these equations. So here you can see you can solve this equation by setting the anomalous dimension of Newton's constant to be -2. And indeed, giving the explicit expression on the previous slide, you find that there is a certain value, g and lambda, both positive, where this is really satisfied, and also the second equation here vanishes. And here it turns out that this fixed point is UV attractive in both directions, g and lambda. And this is exactly the requirement one needs in order to use it to define a fundamental theory. So this fixed point is the one at the heart of the asymptotic safety conjecture. And the idea is that if this fixed point exists in the full theory, we can use it to define a consistent and predictive quantum theory of gravity. One can do one step more. One can go and solve the equations which we had on the previous slide numerically to get an idea what the properties of the RG flow are. And this solution is depicted here. So at this point, you see this is the non-Gaussian fixed point which we had before. Here we have Newton's constant on this axis, cosmological constant here. So the Gaussian fixed point is sitting here in the origin.
So the arrow points in which direction?
It's in the infrared. So up here, this is UV scale. And following the arrows, you get to the infrared. And what you see is that all trajectories with a positive Newton's constant actually are attracted to this fixed point if you go to very high energies. On the other hand, then it's the question, where is general relativity in this plot? This is actually down here in this regime. So here you have general relativity with a positive cosmological constant. Here, this single trajectory is general relativity with a zero cosmological constant. And on this side, it's with a negative cosmological constant. So what you have to take into account that is that this plot shows dimensionless quantities. So you have to mentally rescale them with a power of k. And then you see that this behavior actually corresponds to a constant Newton's constant and constant cosmological constant. There's one particular feature in this plot. And this is depicted in this line here. So everything that goes to positive cosmological constant cannot be continued to the deep infrared. So here the RG flow terminates at a finite value of k. So we will come back to this point later on, I hope.
So how does that sit with the dimensionful constants? If the dimensionless constants are at most something 0.5, the lambda max, so the dimensionful one, it's
It depends on precisely which RG trajectory you pick here. Like, if you want to ask the question, where are the constants you measure in nature, then it will tell you you have to do an extreme fine-tuning. So positive cosmological constant is on this branch. And you have to squeeze your trajectory into this very corner before it turns. And then you get a tiny value of the cosmological constant and the observable value of Newton's constant. More questions about this? Okay. So then let's go on and translate this picture in properties of space-time. So what can we look at? If we want to describe a fractal spacetime, there are certain notions mathematicians know which can be used to characterize particular properties of a fractal. So the first one, probably all of you have already seen, is the so-called Hausdorff dimension. So the idea what happens here is we want to cover a certain set of points with balls. And typically, if we change the radius of a ball, we need more points to cover the set. And this allows us to define a generalized dimension, the Hausdorff dimension of a set, by taking the derivative of the logarithm of the number of points with the radius r and taking the limit r goes to 0. There are two famous examples for this. So the trivial example is we could try and cover a real line with balls. And once we change the size of the ball, we probably need a number of balls which increases proportional to the radius of the ball to the minus 1. So substituting this equation up here gives us Hausdorff dimension 1 as we would expect for a real line. The picture gets more interesting if we look at the coastline of England. So here, this is the cartoon version. We covered the coastline with balls of different sizes. And then you see that here the ratio is actually non-trivial. So the coastline has a Hausdorff dimension of 1.2. So if you shrink the size of your meter stick, you need more balls to cover the coastline than you would do for a straight line. The second quantity encodes some dynamical properties of our spacetime. So the idea is to set a particle on your spacetime. You look at random walks on the spacetime, how this particle diffuses. And this is described by the heat equation. So this is given here. So this is the Laplace operator built on the metric of your manifold. The big capital T is the diffusion time. And then we can ask, what is the probability of the particle returning to its initial point after a given diffusion time T? So this is expressed here in this equation. We have the heat kernel K. This can be translated into the trace over our Laplace operator, or it has a well-known expansion in terms of the heat kernel. And what you see is that this expression actually knows something about the dimension of spacetime. So this enters here or here in the heat kernel expansion. So taking this knowledge, we can then define the spectral dimension as the logarithmic derivative of the return probability with respect to the diffusion time t in the limit t equals to 0. And if we plug this expression into here, we see that for a standard manifold, the spectral dimension will agree with the dimension we have up here, so the thing that appears in the volume. But having this expression, it's useful in terms of quantum gravity. Do not restrict yourself to infinitesimal random walks, but have a spectral dimension also for finite length random walks depending on t. So the formula will stay the same, but we not go into the limit t equals to 0. The third quantity is associated with the diffusion process itself. So the particle leaves a trail on the manifold, and also this trail encodes some information about the properties of the manifold itself. So this can be used to define the so-called walk dimension of a random walk. So again, we look at the probability density for our particle, and we ask, what is the time the particle needs to diffuse a certain distance x squared on our manifold? And in flat space, this displacement is proportional to the diffusion time t. So then we can use this relation, generalize it on a fractal and say, okay, we have a behavior, the displacement square will be proportional to t squared divided by the walk dimension. So this expression defines what we understand by the walk dimension. And also here, it's useful to generalize to finite random walks instead of taking the limit t equals to 0. Then there's a certain relation between the three quantities which we have just introduced. This is called the Alexander-Orbach relation, and it typically holds if your fractal has some homogeneous properties. So this relates the three quantities, the spectral dimension, the Hausdorff dimension, and the walk dimension on the manifold. So in the next part of the talk, I would now like to apply these definitions and see how we can calculate them on the level of the functional randomization group. So, how do our spacetimes differ from classical ones? So the idea, if we have a classical spacetime, it will be governed as a solution of the Einstein-Hilbert. In general relativity, the equations of motion are given by the Einstein-Hilbert action, and then we can derive the Einstein equations, and by solving these equations, we will obtain a metric which is actually valid at all length scales. So in this case, we have a classical manifold equipped with a metric, and we can apply all the classical definitions which we had on the previous slides. What now changes in terms of our quantum spacetime is that we replace the Einstein-Hilbert action by the effective average action, which we know encodes quantum fluctuations down to a certain scale k. So they are included in here. Starting from here, we can play the same game. We can derive the equations of motion as a variation principle. But what will change now is that through the scale dependence in this action, we will get a family of effective metrics on our manifold. And each physical process comes with a certain momentum scale, and it will probe the corresponding solution of this equation at a certain energy scale k. So in this case, the proper distances the particle will feel actually depends on its momentum. So the situation will be very much like the coastline of England in our example, saying distances measured by a test particle depend on the meter stick, which we use to measure this distance. Yes?
It's defined with respect to some background metric.
Yes.
So there's some background metric here. Which one do you take?
At this level, you have adjusted, you have done the identification that there's only one metric in the game anymore. So in order to calculate the flow, you actually needed to discriminate between the background metric and some fluctuations around this background. But in the end, the physical information in the setup is obtained by equating the background metric with the physical metric.
Okay, but then when you say the metric is seen by a physical process with momentum k, then how do you know? What does it really mean? So this is the momentum k of what? G mu? The g mu depends on k. So I'm saying, effectively. But so if I want to make an experiment that
yes,
this metric, what kind of experiment do you propose? What's the thought experiment you have in mind?
The thought experiment is that you put a particle on your spacetime, like giving a photon with a certain momentum k, and it will feel the structure or probe the spacetime structure at the distance scales 1 over k, essentially.
Yeah, but the notion of momentum and scale depends on the metric. So.
Yes. So simplified, the thought experiment pictures that you can do a flat space approximation, and then momentum will be proportional to the inverse of a length scale. You can be more precise in this identification. Like you can look at eigenvalues of the Laplace operator constructed from this metric g of k, and then say, OK, a process, let's see. Yes. You will, your diffusion process will be set up that it only probes the physics associated with a certain momentum scale. Maybe let me go on and show two more slides, and then it will be more clear how the physics scale K is related to the construction. So, more precise. No. Okay. So, the idea behind this is we now want to promote the return probability to an operator, and in principle, we can compute the expectation value of this operator from a path integral description. And since this step would be very complicated in principle, we want to bypass it, and we want to use the effective average action properties in order to compute the expectation value at a certain scale k. So the idea is that by evaluating this gamma k at the tree at tree level, you have included all quantum fluctuations in the path integral, which come with momentum from infinity down to the scale k. So these are included in the construction of this gamma k. Then we approximate. In the first approximation, we say this gamma k has the Einstein-Hilbert form, which we had on the previous slide. And the equations of motion are depicted here. So the difference between the equations of motion from the Einstein-Hilbert and the one which are depicted here is that the metric and the coupling constants entering into this equation actually depend on this effective scale k. And we can use the scaling relation of the Ricci tensor in order to relate the metrics seen at different energy scales by this conformal factor transformation. And from this, one can relate the value of the Laplace operators that will be seen by a process with energy scale k and k0. Given that one has this equation.
Sorry, is that an assumption that gk and gk0 are related just by conformal transformation?
No. So this you can show is a consequence of this equations of motion.
But I would expect, so why the expectation that gk is kind of a highly known local function of gk0 is wrong? Here you have a local relationship. So I would expect that g of x at scale k is kind of a, you know, a non-local function of g of x of a region which are of size divided by k k0. One is of course gradient of the other.
Now, physically, if you think about coordinates on your space-time, we are looking at the same patch. But the metric seen with different momenta on this patch will be different by exactly this conformal factor. So you derive these equations of motion by the assumption that Einstein-Hilbert is a good approximation for your gravitational action. And
but that by itself doesn't tell you that the proportion is.
And this proportionality follows from, so in principle, you can solve this equation at a fixed scale k0 by just saying this is a certain value of the cosmological constant u will probe at a certain scale k.
I mean, this mapping is consistent with the previous equation.
Mm-hmm.
But you see there are no more assumptions. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do.
When you use the same gauge.
You what?
You use the same gauge, for instance, for.
The same gauge for?
For computing these two.
Yes. No, I want to relate solutions of these equations at different scales.
Yeah. You're saying that this just follows from this equation.
Yes. And I essentially say that the functional form, how this G mu looks like, will be the same. It will not.
I think the first equation is a very small assumption.
Yeah.
This equation is certainly an assumption.
And the arbitrary scale, I somehow approximate by the classical scale.
Yes. So in principle, there can be correction terms to this equation of motion, but this I covered by saying the assumption is that Einstein-Hilbert gives a good approximation of the physics at all scales that I'm looking at. So there could be definitely some additional operators, but the hope is that you can describe the essential physics by having the equations of motion derived from Einstein-Hilbert. And then later on, you can test what happens if you start modifying these equations of motion.
But for which regime of k? Clearly, it's not going to be true for all k.
The form of this equation.
There's a consistency equation, conditions, not somewhere.
For example, if you pull back the second equation in the first, you get that R mu nu at different scales are the same.
But yeah, it's really, if you now say the spectral dimension changes, if you go to smaller scale.
Yes.
And you could wonder what the meaning of R is, for instance, to go to fractal space.
So you wonder if I can still define a curvature tensor if you really want to look at fractal properties.
Yeah, I guess the main point is that it's a bit surprising that you have this equation, which mm-hmm. is classical general relativity at all scales.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There is a rationale behind the logic. I think the answer should be. Okay, give me three more slides. And when we have outlined the structure of space-time that emerges from this picture, we discuss this point again.
Okay,
we relate the spectrum of the Laplace operators at different scales. Then the idea is that the heat equation will also acquire a scale dependence through the Laplace operator. And then we want to solve this equation at a certain momentum regime k. And the idea to do this is use the scaling relation above here and say, okay, at some point we know general relativity will be valid. And in this case, we know that flat space is a good approximation to the physics. So this we will take as a reference scale, and we will expand our probe particle in plane waves at this momentum scale. Then you can find an explicit expression which solves this equation actually. So this is given here. So this is the typical heat kernel for particle in flat space. And the only non-trivial thing is that instead of a 1 here, you have a function f, which actually encodes the ratio between the two cosmological constants at a certain scale. So here's the reference scale, k0, and the momentum scale of the particle p. And if you set this equation to 1, you can do the integral, and then you find that this is really the return probability, rather the heat kernel for flat space, and the return probability you get by equating x to x prime. There is another assumption going in order to actually evaluate this expression to make it useful for our purposes. And this assumption is that if we look at the scaling of the cosmological constant, there will be regimes where the cosmological constant is approximately following a power law scaling with this exponent delta. So once this changes too rapidly, there is a certain maybe I should explain this later when we see the plots. So according to this assumption, you can then derive an expression for the spectral dimension independence of t. And so you see what goes in here is this scaling exponent delta of the cosmological constant.
Excuse me, so this delta has absolutely nothing to do with the f.
The delta.
So the f has no consequence.
The f, you see, the f here contains the cosmological constant. And now you assume that the cosmological constant follows some power law scaling. So you substitute this scaling relation up here. So in this case, you get the f replaced by p to the delta. And then you can evaluate this integral and take the logarithmic derivative according to the prescription. And then you derive this expression. So essentially, if you say that the cosmological constant is constant, so no scaling, you set delta equals to 0, and you recover the classical dimensionality of space-time. While in regimes where the cosmological constant changes with the energy scale, this will reflect itself by non-trivial behavior of this function ds. No, let's skip the walk. Then there was one thing about, the question was already there about the structure of space-time underlying it. What causes the fractal properties of space-time? And one important ingredient to understand this point is looking at the Hausdorff dimension of space-time. And by applying the definition of the Hausdorff dimension, seeing the balls, we need to cover a certain patch on space-time. We see that the space-time itself has a Hausdorff dimension which equals the topological one. So this is important for your question, saying the properties where these whole equations are set up are special fractals in a sense that fractality does not arise from space-time losing points, so it's still a smooth manifold, but all the non-trivial fractal features arise that you have a family of metrics placed on this manifold, which then cause these which induce the fractal features in the dynamical processes like the diffusion processes on the spacetime. So in this sense, you still have smooth patches to look at. There are three consequences from the computation up here. So one I already explained. Spacetime doesn't lose points. All the fractal properties are dynamical, originating from scale-dependent matrices, matrix K. And what you can check is that at every scale, this Alexander-Orbach relation will hold. Let's go one step further and evaluate the expressions for the spectral dimensions. So we can compute this delta by taking the logarithmic derivative of the cosmological constant, and we can translate this relation to a function which then depends on the value of our coupling constants g and lambda. By substituting this explicit value in our formula for ds, we find that the spectral properties of our manifold are actually first independent of particular solutions, which we can find for our RG trajectories, but they only depend on the values g and lambda. So it's an autonomous, it doesn't explicitly depend on the scale k. It only depends on where you are in coupling constant space. This is the result, what we get from analyzing this function. So there is a blue line which separates the coupling constant space in two regimes. So here on this line, the beta function for the cosmological constant is zero. This in particular applies for the non-Gaussian fixed point. And as a consequence, delta is 2, and the spectral dimension is d halves. If we are above this line, beta lambda is positive. That means the spectral dimension is smaller than d halves. And down here, the beta function is negative. And here we have a spectral dimension which is bigger than d halves. So this is in agreement with the picture that we have a classical regime down here. We can take a typical RG trajectory and substitute it into the equation which we had before. And what then happens is that when we start at very high energies, we get a regime where the spectral dimension is approximately constant. So here it's given by 2. This is an exact consequence of the fixed point behavior of the theory. Then we find an intermediate regime where the spectral dimension is given by 4 over 3. So what happens essentially here is that the cosmological constant scales with k to the 4. So the physics behind this regime is that you essentially integrate up vacuum fluctuations. So this is semi-classical corrections to classical GR. And if we go to further lower scales, we see that the spectral dimension approaches 4. So here we recover classical physics. Then it's the question, where are these regimes located on our test trajectory? So this is depicted here. So the 2 regime up here is given close to the non-Gaussian fixed point. The semi-classical part is given here between P3 and P4. So notably, this is already on the way to the non-Gaussian fixed point. So we have passed the classical regime up here. And the last part of the trajectory, the classical part, is given here on this flat, on the part of the trajectory where you already turned around and flow away to positive cosmological constant. what actually motivated our assumption is the investigation is what we wanted to understand is the relation between what we can see using the continuum approach to things people have measured on the lattice. So the story about 5 years ago is that we had the prediction of the spectral dimension, classically D dimension at the fixed point D over 2. And what people measured using Monte Carlo simulations is a classical regime where spectral dimension is 4, and for short random walks, it reduced to 2. So this fitted very well with the general predictions we had from a non-Gaussian fixed point. But then there was a story which became more complicated about 2 years ago when other groups started to do simulations. So here we were in three space-time dimensions. The result was that there is still a classical part of the space-time with 3, but if you extrapolate to small random walks, spectral dimension turned out to 2. And in D equals to 4, there was a new group in Glasgow doing Euclidean simulations, and they measured short random walks with 1.5. So both values are in disagreement with the prediction from asymptotic safety. So the idea was to investigate what is going on in here by comparing the functions obtained for the spectral dimension obtained on the lattice and from the continuum.
What do you mean by Euclidean dynamical trap? What was the third?
It's non-causal.
But I thought that was a completely sick. You can't
change the.
What?
They change something in the model. They change the measure of the model.
Yes.
And claim to, to get a new phase which looks like four dimensions.
Oh, and what was the measure?
Hmm?
What did they do with the measure? Do you know?
They put a term which suppresses lots of symplices around an edge, so you suppress curvature, something like that.
So it's not just dynamical triangulations in the sense that it's just not summing over different triangulations.
You sum over different triangulations.
No, it's not just that. Well,
yeah.
It is that with a different action in the simplest language.
You just find in the measure you put this
higher curvature terms.
Higher, yeah.
It's
only counting, so it's not higher derivative. It's the local measure.
But it's not the Einstein action either.
The
so they added a third parameter in order to mimic the space probed by CDT, but it does not easily translate into an additional term which you can express in terms of an action.
So they did something in addition to the old Euclidean English to answer this question.
There's one more parameter.
This is another thing which is
there. One more parameter.
Yes.
But what you reported there doesn't depend on the on the choice of that parameter. Or they tune that parameter somehow.
Typically, they need to tune one
to the phase transition.
To the phase transition.
To the phase transition.
They have an extra parameter, which is the power with which they suppress the number of symplices.
Mm-hmm.
And you must tune this to a phase transition in order to get the phase transition.
Yes, okay.
Okay, so what did CDT actually look at? And at this point, I should acknowledge the work by Benedetti, by Dario and Joe, who gave us access to their simulation data. So this part of the project would not have been feasible if they didn't share what they obtained from their simulations. And the typical data set is depicted here. What follows is that you have three areas. So you have very long random walks. And here you see that the simulations is actually finite volume. So here you have an exponential fall off of the spectral dimension, which can be related to the fact that the triangulation is compact. So essentially here, it's the lowest eigenvalue of this space-time which dominates this part of the spectral dimension. Then there are very short random walks on this side, and here you feel that space-time itself is discrete. So this causes this oscillation jumps in the spectral dimensions. So this is also not a good part of the data to look and compare to the continuum. And then there's a chunk of good pieces, so between random walks in the length 20 and 500. And this is the part which we want to compare to. So what did they do to measure their spectral dimension? Is they took the data, and then you approximate this data by a fit function. So Renate Loll would have taken this fit function, and then you extrapolate this fit function to t equal to zero, and then you will find a spectral dimension which is about 1.4. What is not good is that this is not a perfect fit of the data. So what Dario and Joe discovered is that if you take a different interpolation, you really cover all the data points and you are robust against removing data points from up here and down here, and you still get the same result from interpolating. And that's how they came up with spectral dimension 2 for very short random walks. So then, how can we compare what they did on the lattice with what can we can see in the continuum? And the idea was, we have a function, a spectral dimension, and dependence of t.
So if you say what Renate Loll would do.
Yes.
So she would do that in 3 dimensions or in 4 dimensions?
No, there are 2 different proposals of functional forms of fitting the data.
For the same data?
The same data.
So, and one reaches 1.4 and the other 3?
Yes.
So it's kind of...
Yes, it shouldn't depend on the fit function you have.
Yeah, okay.
So in these Monte Carlo simulations, there's some kind of arbitrariness how you interpolate between 2 plateaus. And this is the first proposal, and
so
the other one was the same.
So would see in 3 dimensions, she gets 1.4.
Yes, if I take Dario's data and Renate's fit function, I get 1.4.
Yeah. But didn't Zeno ever look at 3 dimensions, at the spectral dimension,
no.
The 3 dimensional simulations?
No.
But do you have like values for chi squared or something to tell how?
Yes. So the second, the new functional form for this data is way better in terms of a chi-squared fit. So this is really good.
And if you take the, but probably no more use. If you take Renate's 4-dimensional result.
Yes.
And check the fit function there.
This requires having access to Renate's data, actually.
It's a usual problem, okay.
Okay, how could we see this result from our approach? So the goal is determine the RG trajectory which underlies the spectral dimension which has been measured in CDT. So the idea is we take our beta functions, we integrate them with some initial value to determine an RG trajectory, and if we substitute this given RG trajectory in our expression for the spectral dimension, then we will get an expression that depends on the length of the random walk and the initial conditions of this trajectory. Then you take the data points and you minimize the Euclidean distance between the prediction here and the actual measured values. And by minimizing this expression, you determine the trajectories that fit the trajectory that fits the data best. The result that comes out of the procedure is as follows. So we had 3 data sets. We can find initial conditions for our trajectories. And the bigger the data set, the better the fit actually got. So the mistake which we made here decreases if the size of the simulation actually increases. Then you can convince yourself that the GFIT gives a reasonable good description to the data. So the green line up here is what we obtained as continuum values for the best fit trajectory, and the blue data is what is going on the lattice. And here we get a fit that is comparable to Renata's fit function actually in quality. This is the relative error between our function and the CDT data points. And you see in the best case, the largest triangulation has about 1% relative error with respect to the data. So for the crude approximation we did with the Einstein-Hilbert, we were really surprised that it works that well. From this, we could then also understood what was going on with the prediction for the fixed point. So in this plot, we extrapolated both functions, the CDT function and our prediction, to very small random walks. And then you see that the gray band, the data is actually located here. And the two approaches rather predict a very different interpolation function. So in the regime where we have data, they agree reasonably well. And then if you use the continuum extrapolation, then you see that there will be two more regimes where the spectral dimension goes down to 1, and here the fixed point regime is 1.5. But these are regimes which are not probed by current QEG CDT simulations. So somehow one needs to get data points at a smaller physical scale in these to really determine if there is a fixed point or not. Maybe I should skip this part and directly go to the conclusions. So one in the conclusions is we had a picture of the space-time structure emerging from the functional randomization group. So what we used as good probes are the spectral walk and Hausdorff dimensions. And we expect that these are good probes to compare different models of quantum gravity, irrespective of where they come from. So this is something that typically one could also look at in loop quantum gravity. For the asymptotic safety, we had identified three regimes. So there's classical spacetimes, there's a semi-classical spacetime, where this is actually lower than the fixed point value, and the typical signature of a non-Gaussian fixed point reflects itself by having a ds equals to 2. We have seen that in the range where we have Monte Carlo data, this, the functional form here actually is in good agreement with the data, and we found that there's actually no Monte Carlo data which has data points in this or this regime.
So CDT is very infrared for you?
Yes. So it only probes the transition between classical and semi-classical, and it has not probed any plateau structure. Then there's a brief outlook. So what we want to look at is what happens if, so all the data here was pure gravity, what happens if we do also meta fields in the simulation. And what is also useful is, in order to improve the comparison to Monte Carlo simulation, is study spectral dimensions on spatial slices. So this gives some additional information which can be compared. There's a clear homework assignment for people doing discrete approaches. So it seems mandatory that we extend simulations down to smaller length scales in order to probe at least the semi-classical regime and see if we are at the level of the same physics. On the other hand, knowing the fractal structures here, one can also think independently of if there is a model, a model fractal, which mimics the features that have been observed here. So all in all, there's still a lot of things to do. Thanks.
It's time for additional questions.
So where's your Planck scale? I mean, is it in the semi-classical machine or?
It's
so difficult with dynamic triangles. Somehow difficult to hold dynamic triangle issue.
So one expects the Planck scale to be between this point and this point somehow. So around here, I would guess.
Which corresponds to spectral dimension of what?
It's between the two flat parts of the between. Well, it's the transition actually. We have it here. So somewhere here, you start having non-trivial
between
quantum.
Between 4 and 1.5 or something.
Hmm?
Between 4 and 1.5.
Yes. But you shouldn't attribute too much significance to regions where the spectral dimension changes rapidly.
Mm.
So from a mathematical point of view, talking about spectral dimensions only makes sense if it's constant over a long regime. So we found that we can modify this interpolation between the two regimes by, for example, putting in additional terms in the ansatz for gamma k, which we used to derive. So
you said that your flow equation were done for an optimized cutoff.
Yes.
Are the numbers you get dependent on the cutoff? So if I take a non-optimal cutoff function, do I get different numbers for these dimensions or?
For the dimensions, for the interpolation here, yes. For the plateaus, no. Because the plateaus you can associate with fixed point structures in your flow diagram, which are independent on what the regulator is.
So what you say is basically that because you see in your scenario, this part where the dimension changes is actually non-physical. You basically say that what they did in CDT probes a very non-physical regime where you know the dimension reduction doesn't have any meaning.
It's two different methods, right?
It's two different methods. So
what
we observed is that we can
replace it.
Hmm?
In your picture, you place the results in the unphysical regime. So the methods are different, but in your picture, they fall in the unphysical regime.
No, what this regime probes is something like leading quantum corrections to Einstein-Hilbert.
Okay, which you said that they are dependent on the cutoff scheme and so on
yes.
and so forth. So for you, this is not really a physical regime where it changes abruptly. And this is where you play CDT.
This is where the CDT data points are located. But I think they would have a
they might have a different
view
on
this.
This
way,
yeah.
And here it's that the results are cutoff dependent, but probably that it goes down is not too much cutoff dependent.
No, this is
if you assume continuity. But you would say that basically you can apply this method way beyond Planck scale.
Which method? You mean?
This method. I mean, you had all these ones since you had the equations which were Einstein-Hilbert equation and they were really classical equations. And
no, it's a crucial assumption that goes into that beyond the Planck scale, Einstein-Hilbert is still a good approximation to the true physics. From all we know in
you
this flow equation,
it's a reasonable assumption? Or?
It's an assumption. I think, personally, I think it's a reasonable assumption.
Why? I mean, you would expect, the reasonable thing would be to expect non-locality to kick in. At some point, the equation that's going to govern you know, it's going to become highly non-local. And you know, so therefore, you know, if you go below the Planck scale, then the local equation doesn't describe any more the physics. So why do you expect that the local equation works at such a scale?
So what we schematically did with this equation is to test, where is this? To test this relation by modifying the ansatz which we had here. So think about you put in a different curvature monomial which is not covered by Einstein-Hilbert. And what happens at this level is that essentially this is the leading term in an expansion series, and the expansion is actually controlled by the value of the dimensionless cosmological constant.
So you're talking about a finite truncation in terms of higher dimension.
Yes.
What I'm talking about is really non-local terms. So let's say infinite number of terms of the form R box to the power n R. This one, you know, the one which are being to completely delocalize.
Yes. I wish I could say something about these terms. So,
is there any simulation where people have included these terms? The non-local.
There is a single work in two dimensions where these terms come in form of the Polyakov anomaly. And this we can reproduce, but there was no further progress on including such terms in the flow. So it's a very complicated problem technically.
So I'm a little confused by your answers to Razvan's questions and the related questions. Because some of the things you showed seem to have an agreement between CDT and what you're saying, like the two-dimensional two dimensions at small distances. So are you saying that those are just coincidences now? We shouldn't take them seriously because the CDT never actually penetrated into the true fixed point, neighborhood of the fixed point.
So what the statement is, it's clearly that CDT never probed the region below the Planck scale.
So the original agreement with two was just fortuitous? We should just forget about that now, or what?
I think this agreement was purely accidental. So you can also find the state. Where did I have the list? Yeah. So I think this agreement between this two and this two is accidental. So this two is actually measured by extrapolating physics above the Planck scale.
Why did you call when you distinguish these three regimes, you call the intermediate regime semi-classical?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you call it like that? Can you derive it from, I don't know, one loop corrections?
Yes.
In what sense is it semi-classical?
Essentially, it's a one loop correction to the lap running of the cosmological constant, which is responsible for this regime.
And so one loop corrections are somehow producing the fractal dimension?
Yes.
So do you have any intuition why should that be, or how can that be?
It's, what you want to compute is the leading quantum correction to the cosmological constant, and this will go like energy to the fourth power in four dimensions.
And how does that translate into a fractal dimension of 4/3 or whatever it was?
Yep. This is
When you say branched polymer, it doesn't sound very...
A branched polymer is...
Very semi-classical.
So, answer the first question. So, the translation is if you have a scaling of the cosmological constant going like k to the d, then it translates over this construction in the spectral dimension, which is then 8 over 6 or 4 over 3.
Did you explain why? Is there some intuition? Where did that formula come from?
You change the heat kernel there, which is f of.
Sorry?
And the k, and the heat kernel.
Yes.
Set of a to the minus p squared.
Okay, and where's the heat kernel?
In the line below, you have the solution for the heat kernel.
Okay.
And there's an exponential minus p squared. Usually, you have just exponential minus p squared.
Yeah.
Mm. But now we have to plug in this f over p squared. F of p squared.
Okay, I'll have to do it. Why is that the thing you have to plug in?
So you get actually not p squared, but k to the delta. So you get another power there.
Okay, well, I can ask later maybe.
Yeah. I guess this f over p comes just from the rescaling of the matrix.
Yes. Yes.
Which you had
before.
The scaling of the matrix.
So the claim was, which we were discussing,
yes,
that the matrix at different scale are just rescaled by this power. Lambda over p divided by lambda over p.
Yes.
And that induces that other scaling of lambda, is that
now the point which we had some debate about is that at different scales you see a different set of metrics which are related by a conformal factor, which is given by the ratio of the cosmological constants measured at the two different scales.
It sounds almost self-contradictory, because what can set the scale other than the metric itself? What does it mean to see different metric and different? But maybe that's the discussion you were having.
This was exactly the discussion we had earlier.
Still, I mean, can you see? Because if you call it branch polymer, can you, you know, if I look at the metric, it doesn't really look at it like a branch polymer if you just do conformal rescaling.
No, I should clarify the comment. What I mean by branch polymer. So if you look at old CDT simulations, you remember that there are three phases coming up, and one is called branch polymer.
Yeah.
And the spectral dimension that appears in the branch polymer phase is 4 over 3.
Yeah. Okay.
What we do not.
Essentially, you can prove it. So you can take a branch polymer by definition, which is 3, blah, 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 and actually compute it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a discrete computation. It says that the branch polymers have 4 over 3.
Yeah, no, okay. Yes. But you just say it's a branch polymer because of the spectral dimension.
Yes. So, in a sense, you could wonder if points in this phase probe a different part of your RG trajectory.
So let me understand something. So in the same classical regime, you have a first loop correction, which gives like k to the power 4.
Yes.
And then you have a classical regime in which you completely lost that. You have a regime in which the cosmological constant doesn't scale anymore.
Yes. So if you start the running of the cosmological constant, lambda of k, it will start by a constant term, lambda of 0 infrared value. Then there will be a second term plus coefficient times k to the d. And at some point, second term will take overwhelm the first one.
But do you have anything after the second term?
Yes.
Which would be k to higher power? Therefore?
I'm not sure that this is, that it's really a power, that you can sensibly expand this function in the powers of k. At some point in an energy regime, you will scale like Well, in the fixed point regime, you should scale like k squared. So there, a different power has taken over.
With respect to the constant and the k4.
Yes.
So you have the constant in the IR, then you have the k4 which appear,
yes.
And then you get the k4 and you get the k squared.
Hmm?
I'm not sure if you answered the previous question about how, if you say one loop, then that's just linearized perturbations about whatever,
yes.
Layout or something.
You should.
How can that give anything like a branched polymer form of the metric? Isn't it just an accident if they agree? Are you just using the word branched polymer just to mean for it through? You're not claiming that
yes.
It's actually a metric that bears any relation.
I'm not claiming that there's any relation between the metric structure. It was just the remark that exactly this value has been observed in the branched polymer phase on Monte Carlo simulations. If this is an accident or not, I don't know.
But do you have a picture of what the metric is like?
It's yeah.
No, we never computed any explicit metrics.
With this equation, it says the metric at different scales is just a rescaling of the metric at the large scales.
Oh, at all scales, it's just a rescaling. So it's always flat, for example. Mm-hmm. But rescaling by a very position-dependent amount, or by is it just by a scale-dependent?
Scale-dependent.
But then it's yeah, then it's.
Welcome.
Okay, I see. I should.
Which comes from saying that all the metrics satisfy the same Einstein equations.
I understood.
So if you match the solutions one for one, it's just rescaling.
Okay, so I think we should thank Frank again and follow the discussion privately
yes.
later. Thank you.